each meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
And good afternoon and welcome to Winds of Change. This is Mary Helen Fiorito. I am the Cardinal Francis George Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., and I am privileged to be sitting in today for Father Anthony here on listener-supported Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ. And we're going to be speaking about a health issue today, which is a little bit different than what we normally talk about here on Winds of Change, but it's a health issue that impacts millions of Catholics around the world. And that issue is something called celiac disease. Celiac disease is a genetic autoimmune disorder that's triggered by the consumption of gluten. And gluten is the protein that you find in wheat and barley and rye and in toothpaste and in shampoos and in lotions and in lots of other things, Twizzler candy, that you might not expect to find gluten in. Gluten causes severe intestinal damage and a lot of other symptoms for people who have this genetic predisposition to celiac disease. And it can lead to very, very serious health consequences for people who mistakenly or intentionally consume gluten if you've got celiac. So today, to help me work through the issues that impact Catholic celiacs, is Father Joseph Noonan. And Father Noonan and I are very, very longtime friends since before Father was a priest and before I was married. So that goes back a long way. He is the pastor of St. Damian Church in Oak Forest. Is that correct, Father?
That is correct.
Okay.
Good morning, Mary.
And good morning. And thank you so much for being here, Father. So that our listeners have a sense of you and your background, tell us, how long have you been a Catholic priest?
Well, I was ordained in 1995.
Okay.
May 20th.
Right. So I was there. I was there as your friend.
It was very fun.
Yes.
Fun to have you there. And it was a little bit of a journey. You asked me to mention before the show a little bit about my bio. So I went to Purdue University, studied accounting, graduated, and became a CPA, worked for Ernst & Young in the city of Chicago. And after several years of doing that and then eventually working for my parents' company, Bobby Noonan's Childcare, felt a call to the priesthood. Mm-hmm. So I entered the priesthood seminary, Mundelein Seminary, in 1990, ordained 5 years later.
Right. Well, thank you. Yeah, it's so now you're the pastor of a very, very big parish.
It's very, very vibrant.
Very vibrant parish,
wonderful,
right?
People.
How many families registered in your parish?
Well, as you know from other pastors that you're friends with, it's nebulous when you ask about a number.
Well, that's true. Yeah, registration numbers don't technically mean anything.
3,000 to 3,500 families.
My goodness.
Yeah, it's a very vibrant, very active parish.
Wow. And so of... how many masses would you have on a weekend then?
We have seven. So we have one on Saturday evening, five Sunday morning, and one Sunday evening.
Well, that's, I mean, you know, that's a lot of work for you, I can imagine. So I know.
It's good
yeah.
stuff, though.
So I'm all the more grateful to you for making time in what I know is an exceptionally busy schedule, because not only do you have a parish, but you also have a school.
We do.
And how many children enrolled in your St. Damian's?
We're approaching 380 this year. We're still taking pre-kindergarten children. Well, actually, children in other grades as well. But it seems that, you're a mother yourself, that some of our moms with 3 and 4-year-olds who have not enrolled seem to wait a little bit.
Right. Yeah.
So we're still getting them in last
sometimes
year.
Until the morning that school starts,
that
depending
would be a pleasant surprise.
On the organizational skills of the mom.
We are very welcome for that pleasant surprise for our 3 and 4 year olds. Yeah, we have a very vibrant pre-K academy, and the wonderful fruits of that is that it is growing into a larger kindergarten and first grade. So that's exciting.
Right. And that's, I think, for when I went to Catholic elementary school at St. Angelo's on Chicago's west side, there wasn't even a Catholic kindergarten. So, I mean, everybody just started in first grade. Mm-hmm. And now I think the entry point for a lot of Catholic families into the Catholic school system, are those preschool and early childhood programs. So, now, Father, you're having a special little fundraiser right now at St. Damian's. And I want to be able to, it's called Overhaul the Hall. So
Overhaul the Hall. You might say annual raffle, but it was on a break with the Two Teachers Christus, I think, as many Catholics know from their parish. But we have already completed the work of a 360-foot length hall, renovated by tearing up the flooring, and it's got a beautiful new tile floor, and as well as the entire ceiling taken down with new lighting.
Wow.
It's gorgeous. It's absolutely gorgeous. So this benefits certainly our school, religious ed, and really every parish group that comes into our campus goes through this hallway. So it's you might say, one of the main arteries to our parish.
Okay. Yeah. Well, my own parish, St. Vincent Ferrer in River Forest, is also in the midst of constructing a new multipurpose hall for the kids to have lunch, a nicer place for them to lunch, for a new adoration chapel, for parish meeting rooms. And our pastor has shared with us the sort of unknown expenses that can up when you're doing it. Yeah, as a pastor, you're an accountant, so at least you had the preparation for this.
Sure.
A lot of priests don't have that kind of.
So just to finish the plug.
Yes, please.
Thank you very much. For those of you who would like to support, certainly a Catholic school, a Catholic parish, but also who like raffles, a lot of people who do have a good time with these. We are drawing in just 2 weeks, less than 2 weeks now, Saturday the 26th of August at our Damian Black Party. And we are also going to be drawing publicly, so it'll be out in our parking lot. We had hundreds of people last year. It was very fun. To get a ticket, please look at our website, www.damian, spelled with an A, D-A-M-I-A-N, so Damian with an A. raffle.com.
All right, very good. And what I like about this raffle is listener's father did hand me a ticket that has to be filled out still by myself when he walked in. But the odds are good. You're only selling 2,000 tickets.
We don't mess around.
Because I did not win the Mega Millions, nor the Powerball this weekend, Father. So
I didn't even match one number.
Yeah, so this is... Yeah. I didn't even look. All I know is I didn't win. So this seems to have better odds than the Powerball and the Mega Millions, and it's going to help a good cause. So, Father, thanks for sharing that information with us. I think sometimes people, they don't realize the amount of financial expenses that it keeps to run a parish like that. And so with everybody chipping in, rather, their little bit, we can really all make a big difference. And those kind of parish halls do, provide incredible opportunities for ministry, but also for, social events and things that are really important to communities. So they really, a parish like that really is a touch point for the entire community, Catholic or not. So, well, Father, so we're going to talk about celiac disease today, which, as you know, it's not a gluten allergy. Listeners who follow me on social media and on Facebook and follow some of my writing at National Review and at Alatea know that I have 3 children with celiac disease. Mm-hmm. So I do not have it myself. I have been tested, but all of my children do. And so I am more than a little familiar with it. But Father, can you? You've had your diagnosis, gosh, since I've known you.
Right.
So
right, I'm a celiac myself.
Yeah. So tell me, how did you come to be diagnosed?
Well, it was through my sister. So I have 6 siblings, and through our childhood and being raised, my mom just inherently knew. I guess you're a mom yourself, Mary, and she could just see in which ways food caused us to either be hyperactive or maybe depressed or not in a good mood. And just through her own, you might say, natural intelligence.
Right. Maternal instinct.
Yeah. She actually greatly reduced, as we were growing up, wheat in our diets. So she would not buy coffee cakes. She would not buy cakes. She just knew that it didn't affect us well. However, without a lot of the research and a lot of the you know, good books and articles now. I'd like to plug a book by Carlin Berghoff. You might have seen her book.
So no.
If you want a good book on celiac, especially if you're new to celiac disease,
okay,
and you want to learn how to cook, she's got wonderful recipes. Just Google.
So Carlin Berghoff from the Berghoff Restaurant.
Sure, her
here in
daughter
Chicago
suffers greatly from celiac.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, and so Berghoff root beer is actually gluten free.
Oh, well, you've shared
there
something
you
with me. I didn't
there
know.
So yeah,
that
so if
is
you like
excellent.
Root beer float.
I do.
Get the Berghoff root beer.
Okay,
but just, you know, those are wonderful books and opportunities for people to learn. But my mom didn't have those. You know, I was, you know, I'm 54 years old. So 50 years ago, when she was just learning this from my other siblings, she was just kind of looking at whatever she could get, you know, because there was no online research. So,
right.
And at that point, I think she really, really helped us and saved us from a lot of medical problems by just cutting down everything she could, not realizing that the gluten was in processed foods, but still we ate a lot of whole foods anyway, potatoes, vegetables, you
right.
know, meats. So just through her own maternal instinct, as you described it, she really saved us from a lot of harm, I think.
Well, then how was it that you came to get your formal diagnosis?
Okay,
because
ahead,
normally, yeah. if you've reduced gluten
sure.
intake, sometimes the test results can be skewed.
Well, we jump ahead then. So
okay.
we jump ahead to we go down on our own. And, now, mom never told me not to have cake and, you know,
right.
not to have coffee cake, not to have waffles, not to have, you know, a sandwich.
And you're away at college where that's
yes,
the primary
exactly.
source of nutrition,
and,
right, would be carbohydrates.
And on my own after that, even, you know, buying a pizza on Friday night instead of cooking and those kind of things. But my sister was doing that as well. She's 2 years older than I am. And then she did get married and had she had a wonderful family. But her fourth, I think it was her fourth pregnancy, her body in such a short period of time, I think it was 6 or 7 years, she had four pregnancies. As you know, as most women know, your body gets depleted mm-hmm. by giving your child so many of your nutrients.
Right.
Well, she was suffering from celiac sprue, which means her intestines were not absorbing the nutrients you need.
Right.
And she had some terrible biochemical problems. They went to some doctors. They couldn't really find it. They finally did a biopsy in her intestine and discovered the celiac, antibodies that
right.
you produce.
Right.
So she was diagnosed like 100%. She has this. Within weeks, she had a complete turnaround with her health.
Wow, that's
she felt great.
Great. Especially if it happened so quickly.
Yeah. Well, they gave her, concerned about the baby, they gave her, you know, mega doses of prenatal vitamins.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And getting her going. Well, they were concerned about the child itself.
Sure.
But still, she just a lot of the headaches, the constipation, other things, you know, there's a laundry list. We all know.
Well, more than 200 symptoms,
yes,
right?
So a laundry list out there of symptoms, right?
Right. So after your sister was diagnosed, did everyone in your family get tested then?
Right. So basically at that point, the doctor told her it's a genetically handed down disease.
Right.
And either one or both of her parents had given it to her to tell your parents one or both of them have this disease as well. It's most likely that your siblings either are affected by it or genetically are carrying this gene. So
right.
their children may be affected by it.
So, right.
So she came home and just said, the doctor, really, the easiest way to do this was just simply go on the diet
mm-hmm.
and save yourself a lot of, you know, tests and things like that.
Right.
So to be honest, I went on the diet and it was life changing. It was so
mm-hmm.
life changing for me that I have never been officially tested.
Oh,
but
okay.
I don't need to because
right.
I've had as many other celiacs have had slip-ups.
Right.
Being a priest, right. I get invited to people's houses for
sure,
dinner.
Sure, of course.
And they promise me there's no gluten in the food. And then later, I have a raging headache.
Right.
And I find out later they pushed mushroom soup filled with gluten into the green beans.
And they weren't aware. Or they used
beans.
A pot or a pan that they had cooked pasta
exactly.
in the day before. And that
right.
contained enough gluten that it made you sick.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I've had enough slip-ups that it's for me, I don't need a
right.
test. My
right.
sister went through
The formal testing,
yeah.
right, which is important, you know, for anyone who's listening, especially if you have children, you
right.
might suspect have celiac disease, to not only get the blood test, the number, the antibody number, which will tell you if you there's a strong likelihood you have celiac
mm-hmm.
disease. So it's this,
right.
they call it the celiac panel. And mm-hmm. if you get a number higher than a 4 on this particular test, you're considered positive.
Yeah.
And then that in the United States, at least, to be considered a definitive diagnosis, you have what's called an endoscopy, and they do a stomach biopsy. It sounds a lot more scary and dramatic than it actually is in terms of the procedure. All three of my children had it, and that's how you get a definitive diagnosis. And if you do have that stomach biopsy that confirms that the villi in your stomach have been eaten away by the gluten, then you're actually, your children or you, you're actually protected under the American with Disabilities Act. And so if your child attends a public school, that allows you then to create what's called a 504 special accommodations plan for your child at any school they attend to, and your child is then protected under federal law. And so that's how, that just gives you a sense of how serious a disease celiac is. It's nothing to be messed around with or taken lightly if you have celiac. There's also, you know, people who might have gluten intolerances, but that is not the same thing as having celiac disease because that is genetic.
Right. Celiac for me, when I have, I guess I would call it an episode. Some people call it an episode. It's not an allergic reaction at all. In fact, it's actually later. Like I said, it's during the dinner at a Krishner when I'm ingesting gluten and not knowing it. I feel fine throughout dinner. It's like an hour or two, maybe 3 hours later that the headache starts to come on as I've been affected by the gluten.
Right. And sometimes for people, it's even the next day.
Right.
Well, we're going to go to a break now. This is Mary Fiorito sitting in for Father Anthony today on listener-supported Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
St. Stanislaus Kostka Church is the official sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago. Founded by Polish immigrants in the late 1800s, this historic church is more commonly known as St. Stan's. One church, many cultures, in that masses are held in English, Spanish, and Polish. The church is two blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy. St. Stan's has been so prominent in the history of the church in Chicago that the Kennedy Expressway was even built around it. St. Stan's is easy to get to. It is the sanctuary for quiet prayer before the celebrated iconic monstrance. For Mass and confession times and special events, please visit our new website at ststandschurch.org. That's ststandschurch.org. And while you're on the homepage, feel free to click on the donations tab to help in the continuing restoration of St. Stan's.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ and on the World Wide Web at windsofchangeshow.com.
Every first Friday, Jeff Hammond sits in to host Winds of Change to talk about the First Friday devotion. Jeff is the section representative of the Equestrian Order of the Holy Sepulchre for the Archdiocese of Chicago. Jeff will share the history, tradition, and prayers of the First Friday devotion. First Fridays at noon on Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ and on the World Wide Web at windsofchangeshow.com.
This is Mary Fiorito sitting in today for Father Anthony on Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ. And we're going to spend the rest of the show today talking about a genetic autoimmune disorder, which is a little bit different for us here at Winds of Change. But it's a genetic autoimmune disorder that affects many Catholics and in particular affects the way in which many Catholics can participate fully at Mass. And that's called celiac disease. Sometimes it's called celiac sprue disease. And I'm joined today by Father Joseph Noonan, who is the pastor at St. Damian Church in Oak Forest, Illinois. Father is a priest of the Archdiocese of Chicago and a longtime friend of mine, and very generously gave of his time. And also, I'm very grateful to him for so generously sharing his story with us, because sometimes people are hesitant to talk about particular health issues that they have. But, you know, this is so important to so many different people because so little is understood about it even now. Father Joe was saying he really wasn't aware of the impact that gluten had on his body and the damage it was doing until about 20 years ago. So for many people with celiac, you know, they're not diagnosed until their 20s or their 30s. I know a woman, Father Joe, who was not diagnosed. I think she was in her late 20s, and it was only after she had repeated miscarriages. So you were talking about your sister, and that's how she came to be diagnosed. And listeners, some of you are aware that I wrote an article that was published at Aletea, Aletea.com on celiac disease in Catholics, because all three of my children have celiac disease. And Father Joe mentioned in the first segment how the list of symptoms can sort of be baffling, because there's between 100 and 200 different known symptoms for celiac disease.
So within the same family, too. It's difficult.
Right. So with my the way we discovered it, interestingly enough, is one of my daughters in particular, I had been taking. Now, I look back at her health health records since she was in about between kindergarten and first grade. She started showing signs of pretty severe anxiety. She would twist her hair and pull it out of her head. You know, she would have bad headaches and stomach aches. So really, 4 years, we were going from specialist to specialist, headaches, stomach aches, anxiety. Same three symptoms pretty much. Until finally, when she hit her eighth grade year, the anxiety symptoms became so bad that her Catholic school principal, who was very, very kind to our family, said, listen, you know, we really need to do something to address this formally. Your family really needs to take her to see a specialist. Well, little did he know that we'd been to specialist after specialist, but we wound up going to a Catholic family therapist, thinking it might be an emotional issue, CatholicTherapists.com. I cannot recommend it highly enough. And within 15 minutes of our first meeting with this Catholic family therapist, she looked at my husband and I and looked at my daughter and said, has she ever been tested for celiac disease? And I said, no, no one in our family has celiac disease. Why would we test her for that?
Right.
And she said, your daughter looks sick to me. She said, I want you to have her tested for celiac disease. So I called the pediatrician, and there was a little bit of rolling of the eyes. I could see it over the phone, Father Joe, even though I couldn't see it. But she said, fine, you know, we've tested her. They gave her MRIs for a brain tumor.
Yep.
It's not as if you know, the physician had been dismissive of us. But and sure enough, if you get higher than a 4 on this blood test they give you called the celiac panel, you're considered positive. She had a 322.
I think that's a little higher than 4.
Yeah. So her number, I literally started to cry when the doctor told me that. She tried to reassure me. So I've seen higher. She had such a severe case that in Europe, that would be considered dispositive of celiac. You wouldn't even have to have the stomach biopsy. But the doctor said, you know,
just to follow up.
Right. Well, you need it for the formal diagnosis in the United States. You have to have the stomach biopsy to be protected under the American with Disabilities Act. But then because one child had it, we had to test them all. And sure enough, they all had
it.
They all had advanced cases.
I had a similar situation in my family. I have 6 siblings, as I mentioned earlier, and not all of them were as, you might say, open, because they weren't experiencing the difficulties as I was.
Right.
My sister did. After battling headaches my whole life, literally within 3 to 4 weeks, I woke up one morning without a headache for the first time in my adult life.
Wow.
And it was life-changing, as I mentioned earlier. And so you share that with some of your nephew and nieces, brothers and sisters. But if my brothers and sisters were not experiencing that symptom, because there's so many symptoms, they disregard then that, I must not have celiac because I don't have what you have.
Right.
And briefly, one of my siblings who has some medical background had a daughter who was going through severe depression, and they went to specialist after specialist after specialist, and then finally wanted to put her on some significantly serious medications, some drugs. And we had conveyed to them over and over that on the list of symptoms is depression. And please just try it. It's just
a blood test.
It's just going into Kroger or Jewel and picking different food off the shelf.
Correct.
It's actually much easier than it used to be. And within a month, her depression was completely gone without medication.
Yeah. And that is the case for a lot of celiacs. And I think, again, the one thing that's sort of baffling about this disease is that there are so many types of symptoms. And as our pediatric gastroenterologist explained to us, not every person has the same symptoms. So even among my 3 children, you know, one had anxiety and headaches and stomach aches. Another one, you know, had some constipation and stomach aches, but no headaches and really no anxiety. The eldest one had some other symptoms. So everybody has very different symptoms. But when you sort of add all of them up, they often lead to celiac disease. So it's interesting there, Father Joe, there was an article in the New York Times, an opinion piece, maybe just a month ago, written by a doctor who was arguing for the celiac panel being part of the regular screening process for kids.
I think it should be.
And
it
really should be. It's funny. There's a conversation going on within the medical community. Part of the disagreement is not that they really don't think the test is worthwhile, but because celiac can be triggered at any point along. So you're born with the gene and you add gluten, but they don't know what that trigger is. So the one thing, you know,
so you could miss it if you're not triggered early.
Right. So if you have the test when, say, you're 5 or 6, and then say the trigger happens when you're 7 or 8, then, you know, you could go well into adulthood thinking, well, I've been tested for celiac and I don't have it. So people I know who have celiac disease that runs in their family, the whole families are just tested once a year. just as a matter of fact, because it is.
That's smart.
Yeah, which
that's
I think smart is a smart thing to do because
sure.
the damage is pretty severe, and the consequences of not following a gluten-free diet if you have celiac disease are pretty significant. And they do include early death, and they do include miscarriage for women, and they do include stomach cancer.
Most
and
definitely.
Yeah.
And even if you have a lesser, you might say, of an impact on your body, your quality of life suffers.
I mean, oh, absolutely.
For me, just having headaches every day.
Every day. Yeah, my daughter was like that,
it was
literally.
Not a good thing.
I mean, to the point, as I mentioned, you know, the pediatrician even tested her for a brain tumor with the MRI, even though
right.
she kept saying she has no neurological symptoms, but... You know, I know she's not making these headaches up, but, you know, it was incredibly frustrating for us as a family. And I have to tell you, a great relief to find out that here's the medicine. The medicine is not to eat gluten, but you have to be vigilant about the no gluten.
Very, very vigilant.
And that includes, I mean, I threw out the toaster. I had to throw out most of our pots and pans.
And discipline, too.
I mean, right.
It's a situation where for a young person, it can be awkward. You go to a birthday party. You're the only one not eating birthday cake. You're,
right.
you know, going to maybe for a little, you know, smaller school age children, if they have a sleepover and, you know, everyone has toast with their eggs.
Right.
And you're not the only one.
And
so
they can't. Right.
You just have to be disciplined. And maybe the parents have to tell the other parents, try to avoid those awkward situations.
Right. And I think, too, you know, and again, I would put myself in this own category. Many, because there is such a, you know, sort of, there are many misconceptions about celiac disease. People think it's an allergy to wheat or, you know, that you can have a little and it won't hurt you.
That's the worst one right there.
That's the worst.
Oh, it's only a little bit.
Right. So, that leads me into what I really wanted to bring you on now that we've had all that background, Father Joe, is to talk about how celiacs can safely receive communion.
Okay.
Because
very
in order important. For, okay, so well, let's start kind of from the beginning. Okay, so we'll go back to the Last Supper and we'll talk about the elements that Jesus used at the Last Supper. Mm-hmm. Father, explain to the listening office why, listening audience, why, as I like to say, the matter matters. Why does what we use for the bread matter?
Sure. Well, primarily we're doing what Jesus did and gave us. So we... Looking through our whole tradition, our history, we don't invent, you might say, sacraments. We don't change them to fit our, you might say, likes, dislikes, our, you know, the trend of the day. No, we're trying to do what Jesus himself did, because as you look through, not certainly in the prefiguring of Christ, you know, the Passover meal, for example, the tradition of the Passover held to Jesus' day. Jesus took that Passover meal and elevated it to not just a remembrance of the freedom from slavery of, you know, the unfortunate Egyptian enslavement of the Jewish people and their entrance into the Promised Land, but also giving us an avenue of his life. You know, we receive the divine life of God in the Eucharist.
Right.
I mean, this is nothing... willfully change.
Right. So we're not free to change it because it was given to us by God.
No.
Correct.
And that's something I think a lot of Catholics, a reader show like this can help us, you know, to remind ourselves, this is a gift from Jesus Christ. This is a gift from our Savior, divine, human. He wants our life to be filled with his presence, his grace. He wants to transform us.
Right.
And so it's not a willy-nilly decision of using a rice host versus wheat. Or using, you know, something instead of wine, we are basically doing what Jesus said: do this in remembrance of me. So the matter matters. We
right.
use wheaten, unleavened wheat bread, and we use real wine.
Yeah. So Jesus said, "Do this in memory of me," not do this and then make substitutions or.
Right.
But this specifically, what I'm laying out,
these
correct?
These specific actions with this specific, you might say, matter and form.
Right. So the bread that we use, what we call in sort of church talk, listeners, Eucharistic matter, which means the bread itself,
right.
the thing that it is made of.
The unconsecrated host.
Correct. You would call that matter.
Mm-hmm.
And the wine. That those are, again, as Father Joe just pointed out, things that have been given to us by Christ for what's called the validity of the sacrament.
Right.
So, Father, can you explain that a little bit?
Right. So we believe that Jesus gave us in the church the gift of the sacrament. So many people go back to the Baltimore Catechism. You know, sacrament is an outward sign instituted by Christ to give grace. You know, it's way back, 1941, Baltimore Catechism. I love that definition, by
right.
the way. And the Catechism of the Catholic Church, you know, John Paul II, 1994, is a little bit, you might say, fuller definition, but not really that too much different. It's the sacraments are efficacious signs of grace instituted by Christ and entrusted to the church by which divine life is dispensed to us. So these gifts that the church has been given, we bring forward in each and every generation. The matter itself of just wheat and water mixed together in a paste and then cooked has been from the very beginning.
Right. For 2,000 years,
it's not changed,
this is what, right.
Now, certainly the way in which you might say the wheat is maybe crushed or the way in which the paste is rolled, I mean, there might be a visible little difference, but it's still wheat and water,
right.
Primarily. That's the matter of the Eucharist.
Well, when we come back, listeners, we're going to continue this conversation with Father Joe Noonan of St. Damian Church in Oak Forest, Illinois, on celiacs and communion. This is Mary Fiorito sitting in for Father Anthony today on Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
Newsflash. This just in, Winds of Change podcast can now be heard on your iPhone and Android phone. Download the TuneIn Radio app and search Winds of Change, and Winds of Change will be right there for your very ears. We now return you to Winds of Change.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ and on the World Wide Web at windsofchangeshow.com.
How shall I tell this great mystery? I am Father Thomas J. Loy with a Theology of the Body moment for the Tabor Life Institute. He who is without flesh becomes incarnate. The Word puts on a body. The invisible is seen. He whom no hand can touch is carried, and he who knows no beginning now begins to be. The Son of God becomes the Son of Man. These words were taken from the Christmas prayers of the Byzantine Catholic Church. Turn our thoughts to the great mystery. God has condescended, bent the heavens, made a gift of himself, and entered into a spousal relationship with his own creation. The entire order of creation, most especially our human bodies, speak the language of this mystery. We are created male and female precisely so that we too could make a gift of ourselves. We too could love as God loves. Christ is born. Glorify him. To find out more about the theology of the body, visit taborlife.org. taborlife.org.
And welcome back. This is Mary Fiorito. I am sitting in today for Father Anthony.
St. Stanislaus Kostka Church is the official sanctuary of the Divine Mercy.
I'm sitting in today for Father Anthony on Winds of Change here on AM 750 WNDZ. And I'm joined today by Father Joe Noonan, who is the pastor of St. Damian Church, which is in Oak Forest, Illinois. It is a far southern suburb. Probably there are Sox fans there, listeners. But
there's a lot of good Cub fans down there.
Are there?
Yeah,
okay.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I'm a person of inclusion and peace, Father, so I'm okay with that.
I go to both. Okay,
that's
sure.
God bless you, sure. Father. That's very beautiful. Okay, so we're talking today. Father Joe has been very generous in driving here to St. Stan's today to spend an hour talking with me about celiac disease, because he is a Catholic priest who actually has celiac, and members of his family do as well. And so we're talking about the issue that I think for most Catholics who have celiac is really the most complicated, and that is how you receive communion safely.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. So.
So. Early on, when my sister and I, she was diagnosed first, and then I quickly followed, and then my other siblings joined in later, we would only receive from the precious blood.
Okay.
The precious blood, we believe, is all of Jesus. So
correct,
when you
right.
come forward, you have the option. But many people don't realize that. So even if they don't have celiac, if they would just prefer to receive the precious blood, that's a very
so
fine.
You've received the body, blood, soul, and divinity, whether you receive
of
only
Jesus
the
Christ.
Precious blood
mm-hmm.
or only the host.
They correct. So literally, there are people who will come forward in line, and you know, when it's their turn to receive the quote unquote host, they just kind of nod and move over and go right to the line for the precious blood. That's
right.
fine. That's very
right.
valid. Now that's what we did for years, until we were introduced to the low gluten hosts. There were a couple different varieties out there. There's an excellent variety now. And I think you and I talked about it on the break from the Benedictine Sisters of Perpetual Adoration in Clyde, Missouri. So if you would like to look into some of that information, I think you have that in your article.
I do. Right. So again, the article I wrote on celiac disease and the Eucharist is available at aletheia.org, A-L-E-T-E-I-A, aletheia.org. And if you just Google Eucharist and celiac disease, my article will come up, as well as some other related articles. But in that article, there is a hyperlink to the Benedictine Sisters of Clyde, Missouri, who were really among the first religious orders.
Revolutionary.
Yeah.
Right.
And they worked for years.
It says 10 years in the article I read. About
right.
Them, yeah.
Right. To come up and with a recipe that would be considered valid matter.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I believe it said right here that in the article I was reading that the Secretary of the Liturgy of the USCCB, so United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, has stated that their hosts meet the requirements of the Code of Canon Law and may be validly used for Mass.
Right. So,
of course, you want to talk to your pastor. You don't
right.
You know, just bring your own. You normally would meet with him maybe during the week. You could actually print out the article you have.
Right.
Show it to him if he's not really well versed with low gluten hosts. But they're valid. They're valid.
They're valid matter. Right.
So as we talked briefly before the break, so the sacraments given to us by Christ have matter and form. And the quote unquote matter, which is the actions and the substance, are very important to do what Jesus did and what he asked us to do. So wheat and water constitutes the host. Well, the Benedictine sisters are able to use that wheat, but after treating it, are able to remove a great extent of the gluten.
Right.
And so why don't you mention what you said
yeah,
before?
Yeah, so I had done a little more research into the host that the sisters provide, first when my children were all diagnosed, but then secondly, as I was preparing the article for Aletheia, .org that I mentioned, and I discovered that the hosts were actually tested by Dr. Alessio Fasano, who at the time was the Center for Celiac Research Director at the University of Maryland, and Dr. Fasano is considered really one of the nation's leading medical experts on celiac disease, and the statement that he made about the sisters' hosts, the sisters have posted on their website, is that someone with celiac disease would have to consume 270 of these particular communion wafers at one sitting in order to reach the danger point for a person with celiac disease to be reactive.
So they're extremely
low gluten.
Right. And they could even, with a low gluten host from the Benedictine sisters, you could even
break that
half
in half.
It,
exactly.
A quarter.
Yeah.
Right. So if you're very, very concerned, just simply minimize that intake as well.
Right. Correct.
But you certainly do not, if you're greatly affiliated by celiac, take just a part of a gluten host. I would not recommend that. So
no.
If you're a Eucharistic minister in a parish and maybe have falsely been told, oh, just a little bit doesn't bother people, that's simply not true. A little bit does bother some people.
Right.
Please don't do that.
Right. No, I think that this is where some confusion comes in because I think there may be people in diocesan leadership or diocesan worship offices throughout the country who simply don't have a good understanding of celiac disease and the danger of cross-contamination. And, in fact, after my article at Aletheia appeared, I got an email from a woman on a diocese in the East Coast, not in the Chicago area, who had just been to a training for extraordinary ministers of the Eucharist with her husband, and said that they were actually told during their training to simply break off a part of the regular host if someone with celiac approached them. And she said, I take it after reading your article, this would not be a good idea. And I wrote her back and said, no, that's a very bad idea. Don't do that.
I refer to it a little bit in this analogy. And again, I don't like violence, but because of my headaches, it makes sense for me.
Right.
It's like if I were to receive a large gluten host, it'd be like hitting me in the head with a big hammer, and taking a little piece is like hitting me in the head with a small hammer.
Right, but you're still being hit with a hammer.
I'm still getting hit with a hammer.
Yeah. So, well,
it doesn't matter what size hammer is. It's still getting hit in there with a hammer.
And here's the other issue for celiacs, and this is what our pediatric gastroenterologist explained to us, is that so the low gluten hosts are not the problem for a celiac who's going to be receiving the Eucharist at a mass in a Catholic church. Cross-contamination is the greater concern, because if you touch, she said, for example, the presider touches 30 regular hosts and then goes and picks up your child's host without cleaning his fingers first. Can you expound on that a little bit, Father?
That's probably the biggest challenge every parish is going to have.
Right.
Is the cross-contamination, because the same minister, for example, in our church and in many other churches, they'll have one designated low gluten host station. So it's not a gluten free station, it's a low gluten station. And they will have both ciborium. They'll have an enclosed ciborium. So again, we don't want even air cross contamination.
Right.
But when someone comes up, the Eucharistic minister sets down the gluten ciborium using the same hands as picking up the low gluten and using the same fingers to distribute. So in training, we do have them right by a table that does have some antiseptic, but does antiseptic remove gluten from your fingers? Probably not.
Right.
So what I've attempted to speak to some of them, and I do need to infuse this in the training, is don't use your left hand at all to distribute communion with gluten.
Right.
And when you take the gluten host, then just only use your left hand for the low gluten host.
Well, what about now?
But that might help a little bit.
Yeah.
But the way, I guess, you know, maybe this is something, because of the show, we can even rethink at St. Damian's. But most places I've gone that have a low gluten station, the person is doing both. We might have to go to a designated, they only do low gluten.
Right.
And they clean their hands before Mass.
Right. And
that may be the way we have to go.
And my understanding, too,
as you
mentioned.
That's a shock to my parish staff listening to this.
Yeah. That's what, you know, again, celiac is one of those things, the more you read about it, the more you learn. And
right.
I only learned recently that cleaning your hands with the antiseptic does not remove the gluten. You have to use soap
and
water.
It kills germs.
Right, but it does not, it doesn't remove the gluten. So
actually
keeping, say, a clean, slightly damp cloth and cleaning your fingers with that would remove more gluten
would
than
be
the...
much more effective.
Correct,
right.
than the antiseptic, which does
think
not.
Of it, I mean, just think of it as something you can visibly see. Like, say, so you had dirt on your hand.
Right.
Well, if you just put some antiseptic and wiped around, you'd not have kind of antiseptic dirt on your hand.
Right.
You know, the dirt's not gone.
Right.
You need to actually physically remove it by wiping it or running it under a sink.
Correct.
And then drying it.
Right.
Yeah.
And then it's gone. And there are some. Now, so that leads me to sort of, I guess, my next point or question or father or opportunity for a conversation here is that, you know, our experiences have been so vastly different depending on the parish that we go to.
Exactly.
So another part of the importance of using the low gluten host, and the sisters, Benedictine sisters, make this very clear on their website, is the proper storage.
Yes.
And so they, because they are so delicate, they need to be stored in an airtight container in a refrigerator or freezer. And so, you know, my 9-year-old, we went to communion at a particular parish, and they did have a low gluten host. But afterwards, she looked at me, you know, with kind of a funny look on her face after we received. And when we got back to the pew, she said, "Mom, that tasted like mold." And it was crunchy.
Boy. Yeah, that's not good.
So, no, that just,
I think we're fortunate in our parish that we have a regular number of people receiving, so they're, they're replenished regularly.
Yeah, right.
So because of that, I think they can be in a regular tabernacle. But if you're only consecrating maybe once a year, it's probably very dangerous. You probably need to. I mean, at some point, these are validly, this is the Eucharist. This is the body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus. If you're in a parish or you're a minister in a parish and you notice that over time your low gluten hosts are not being consumed, just simply talk to the priest about giving them to everyone.
Right.
And then you can replenish them on a regular basis before, like once a week even. You could do it once a week just to keep them
right.
fresh.
Right, because a person without celiac disease can still receive the
low
gluten host.
They,
there's no difference.
They wouldn't really even notice.
Likely not notice. And so, yeah, that's a very, you know, that's a great point, because in that way you would always have it available for the people with celiac. Now, let me ask you this question. I do know of one priest, one pastor, who keeps a separate Pyx, which is a small container that, you know, kind of opens, sort of like a locket might, and keeps it, you know, the low gluten host in there. But then he allows the person to self-communicate. He holds out the Pyx.
They take it themselves.
Mm-hmm. Is that an approach you are comfortable with, or would there be any theological issues with that? Because I know some priests who will not do it that way.
I mean, it comes down to pastoral circumstances, certainly. But at the same time, that's not the desired method to distribute communion. So I think what you were suggesting earlier about someone having a towel on their hand that's moist, that they can physically wipe off their fingers.
Right.
I think that's probably a preferred way to go.
Yeah, I think so, too. Yeah. Along with the symbolism of receiving the Eucharist, you receive it, you don't take it. So, and when we come back, we'll continue this conversation with Father Joe Noonan about celiac disease and communion. This is Mary Fiorito sitting in for Father Anthony on Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
There is a lot going on at St. Stan's. St. Stanislaus Kostka is the sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago. There is Eucharistic adoration before the iconic monstrance, confessions 4 days per week, and masses in English, Polish, and Spanish. There's much more waiting for you here St. Stan's is right off the Kennedy Expressway, just 2 blocks north of Division on Noble. Find out more by going to ststandschurch.org. That's ststandschurch.org, and enter into the presence of Christ.
The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ and on the World Wide Web at windsofchangeshow.com.
You've looked for the right school for your child, but what school? You've worked hard to instill right reason and the values that God has established. And yet, you might be concerned not only with your child's school's quality of education, but by what they may be teaching, maybe undermining what you have worked so hard to instill. Perhaps St. Stanislaus Kostka School could be the positive answer to your questions. Academic excellence and Christ-centered values are the hallmarks of St. Stanislaus Kostka School. To find out what may be the best opportunity for your child, visit ststandschicago.org. That's ststandschicago.org. See the videos, see the students, and see what may be the best decision you can make for your child. Contact the school online or pick up the phone and call St. Stanislaus Kostka School to arrange for a visit at 773-278-4560. That's 773-278-4560.
Welcome back. This is Mary Fiorito. I'm sitting in today for Father Anthony on Winds of Change here on AM 750 WNDZ. And we've had a really interesting conversation today with Father Joe Noonan from St. Damian Church in Oak Forest, Illinois, who has celiac disease. And we're talking about celiac and communion and the proper way to receive and also to store hosts. And Father Joe, you wanted to make a point that we didn't get to finish before the break.
So certainly I think the most important thing is to receive Jesus and not to, I think in a pastoral way, we have to be very, you might say, compassionate to those who are worried about cross-contamination. So the one thought that came up right when we went to break was, if let's say you're in a parish that the pastor is open to consecrating a gluten-free host for you, but maybe the parish does not have a system set up, maybe they don't have their own containers, maybe they're not buying them from the Benedictine Sisters in Clyde, Missouri, you could buy them yourself, perhaps. Talk to the pastor earlier, you know, in advance, get permission to, maybe with the sacristan's help and the pastor's permission, have a host in a pyx and have that pyx placed on the altar, maybe when the gifts are brought forward, or even, you know, depending on when the priest wants the host in the gluten low gluten host placed on the altar. But briefly, in the distribution of communion, as long as he's quote-unquote giving you the host and you're just not kind of like grasping it or taking it, so he really could take that pyx and simply turn it over in your hand.
In the person's hand, and then they...
Yeah, and the right. gluten host would just simply move from
So his hands never touch it, but he's still giving it to you.
It's still the act of distributing it
okay.
to you. I think that would be a very easy solution for someone whose parish does not have something set up.
Right.
I think most priests are very compassionate men. They want to help people.
Yeah.
And I think that would be a very easy solution.
That seems to me like that could be a very, very good workaround.
Right.
But, you know, I Father Joe and I were just laughing at the break because we were saying we never really explained why the whole issue of communion and celiac disease. Right, exactly. What? Where did you pull out this topic? About 6 weeks ago, the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith and Divine Worship, basically, it wasn't even news. It was just a reiteration to bishops around the world to simply be careful about where they're buying their Eucharistic bread. Because, you know, back in the old days, before there was the internet and Amazon, everybody just went to different religious orders
sure.
who made these breads, usually
right.
religious order of women.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mean, you can just go onto Amazon and literally put in communion bread and come up with about 25 different things
right.
that you can buy online. So
mm-hmm.
The Holy See simply wanted to make certain, and Pope Francis approved this,
yep.
that people were getting their Eucharistic bread from proper places,
yeah,
right?
It's a clarification that happens all the time.
Correct. No,
almost every generation.
Right.
And it's not just about the Eucharist. There's probably clarification about how baptism's done this community, but those don't get publicity
right.
like this one.
Oh, well, that's because about six paragraphs down,
there
was a little reminder saying completely gluten-free hosts are not valid matter for the Eucharist. They have to have a trace of wheat, which has always been the teaching. We talked about why it has to be wheat bread, having the resemblance of bread earlier in the show. But the media grasped a hold of that particular line, which again was not news. This was longstanding 2,000-year-old church teaching, and just ran with it. One headline I saw in an Irish newspaper, celiacs will no longer be able to take the body of Christ at Mass under new rules.
Right.
And these headlines went viral.
Absolutely viral.
And to the point that my youngest daughter, my 9-year-old, came home after she'd been out on a drive with her grandma in the car and came in and said, "Mom, I heard on the news Pope Francis said I can't go to communion anymore."
Yeah.
And, you know, that just breaks
it's
your heart. She
sad.
Was so upset. And I said, "Where did you hear that?" And she said, "Oh, Mom, it was on the news. Pope Francis said kids with celiac can't go anymore."
There were a number of people at St. Damien's who...
At your parish,
and outside the parish as well, perhaps because they know I'm celiac, who also were misinformed and believed that they could not receive the Eucharist, even in a local host. So... the misinformation, unfortunately, was promulgated for many reasons, and I think kind of doing a show like this and helping people understand that, low gluten hosts are very valid, I think is a wonderful thing.
They're valid and they're safe for celiacs to receive.
Yep,
so, know, it's I was saying I never thought I'd be quoting Donald Trump on the show, but it was fake news, and it was fake news that really damaged people.
It did.
And
to be honest, there's some of those folks who report religion, I guess maybe reporters, aren't really theologically trained.
Correct.
And you know, the news is probably slower in the religion department than in, like the police beat or political scene. So when they see a hot story, they try to run with it.
Sure.
Without perhaps knowing. So I don't want to throw them all under a bus. I think some of it was not.
No, and there might not have been mean-spirited, intent there.
It was just misinformation.
Right. But it was misinformation that, very easily could have been, investigated before they ran with the headline, checked, because it simply wasn't true. But, one point I made in my Alatia article was that, God makes everything work together for the good. And this gave me opportunities to speak about celiac and communion to all sorts of different people where, we never would have had this opportunity.
And if it raises awareness of some of the basic symptoms, as you mentioned with your daughter, I mean, if that other people are now willing to maybe get tested, I think that's a great thing.
Right. If
so
they're experienced.
Good can come out of this.
Oh, absolutely. And it already has. So, Father Joe, one of the things that, I think perhaps where the church could improve would be to have a more consistent way of distributing the Eucharist to people with celiac disease. As I mentioned, our experiences in my family have been all over the place, from places that don't even keep the gluten-free, low-gluten hosts on hand, to places like yours, where there would be a special station.
With a special enclosed, it's a big hospital pick, so it holds like 100 hosts.
Wow, my goodness.
Yeah, and it's enclosed, so it's not going to hopefully
is that something that you mention in your bulletin every week, if you have celiac disease or cannot receive?
I believe, and I don't want to be incorrect, but I believe we do have constant reminders. I don't know if it's weekly, but we do announce before each Mass that there are low gluten hosts available, and we do point out the station that people can go to.
Right. And so that's a, that's a wonderful way. I have cousins from Ireland who were visiting with us over Easter, and they mentioned that at their parish, because there's so many people in Ireland, Irish and Italians have a higher instance of
Irish is
celiac.
Almost 10%,
believe. It's so that's just a standard thing in most parishes in Ireland, that you would go and there would be a station for celiacs. But one of the, I think one of the dangers of not having a consistent policy that's applicable nationwide is that people will sometimes take rice hosts. And so say you have your own picks at home.
Yeah,
that's that little locket-like, religious article that you can put your hosts in.
Right.
And in fact, I did actually see that on some of the celiac support group blogs, saying just sneak in a rice host. They'll never check. No one will ever know. Father, talk about why it's not only just wrong, but why it is that we wouldn't use a rice host.
Well, we believe it's not validly consecrated.
Right.
So
if
not
you.
Jesus.
Correct. So you're receiving a blessed rice host. You're not receiving the body and blood, soul and divinity of Jesus.
Right.
And so, friends, if that's something, if you know someone with celiac and they have been using a rice toast and bringing it in, that is something that, I used to try to explain this when I worked for the Catholic Church a number of years ago to parents. You can't use this for First Communion.
Right.
And I understood the parents' distress. Their child already feels different enough because they have celiac disease. Mm-hmm. It can be a very isolating disease, particularly for a child. You mentioned, you know,
sure.
I'm hesitant to let my youngest go to sleepovers unless
right.
I know that the mom really understands the extent of my child's illness. There's a lot of things your child is already sort of prohibited from doing. And then when they go to mass and they're still kind of the different kid that stands out, that just makes it all the more difficult for them.
And the one thing I would mention about, like, for example, a very, very exciting celebratory day of the First Holy Communion. When a child comes up to receive the First Holy Communion, there is no way for other people in the congregation to really have any kind of insight that a child is receiving a low-gluten host versus a regular host.
Right. You'll never know.
Or even a part of a low-gluten host.
Right.
I've heard other stories, not specific to my own parish, but from priests in which members of their congregation have actually left, quote-unquote, the church because they wanted their child to receive a host.
Mm-hmm.
So they would actually go to a church which doesn't believe it's Jesus, where it's not validly consecrated, to get a rice host. I don't know if it's for their own... I don't understand how you would not want to receive Jesus
right.
just so you can have a rice host.
Well, that was... yeah, that
it just makes no sense to me when... I mean, think about your own reception of communion, and all listening audience can think of their own. It's... you're facing the priest, deacon, or Eucharistic minister. People aren't looking at your reception of communion. They're not seeing what's actually placed in your hand. And so if the priest takes a low-gluten host from a different vessel and puts it in your child's hand for First Holy Communion, or a part of a low-gluten host from a separate sibling,
only you and your child would know.
No one's going to even know.
Right.
So I really, really, really would like to give a shout-out to parents who are looking at their First Communion for a celiac child and really... First of all, you can try an unconsecrated host, a small piece, to see if that affects them. Maybe even have a test, maybe even do it before they're going in for
right.
a test.
That's a good idea, right.
And just to pursue to receive the very valid low gluten-free host that we have.
Right. And, you know, that was another common theme I saw on some of the celiac kids support groups blogs was, you know, people saying, you know, this was the reason we left the Catholic Church. And
yeah.
and one woman wrote, I quoted her in my article, that her daughter had said to her, "Mom, God made me the way I am, and I'm not welcomed in this church, and it's not fair, so we should leave." And they left, and they went to a Protestant denomination, again, to go where,
right.
you know, they could receive a rice host that's symbolic of Jesus, but it's not Jesus himself. So,
exactly.
yeah,
mm-hmm.
It's that somebody who hasn't...
It's sad.
No, it is sad.
It's
and again,
sad.
If you know, and you don't know what the conversation was like on the other side, pastorally, mm-hmm. at this person's parish, you
sure.
would hope that the minister with whom
right.
they spoke would have been somewhat educated on celiac disease. But as I've discovered, and I imagine you have too, in your many years, that's not always the case.
Unfortunately not. And
yeah.
so that's why this show like this and articles like that you just wrote can really help people to understand the church is very compassionate about this issue. And maybe your individual pastor, because of the many, many plates that they have spinning,
right.
you know, in the air, is not, you know, an expert on celiac or doesn't really even have family members who have it. Maybe they know nothing about it. So
right.
I think, you know, an article like yours shared with a pastor, very easy alternatives like bring a little gluten host into PICS that, again, the parish really then does not have to set up a whole system, but you can work with the pastor on bringing it yourself.
Right. If the pastor is willing to do that,
mm-hmm.
open to doing
sure.
that, because I know, for example, the Benedictine sisters do not let you order your own host. Your parish has
right.
to order
no,
them.
But I'm
yeah.
That
but,
wouldn't have to be a whole gluten-free state or low gluten station
right.
with a, you know, but there are many things that we can do working with our compassionate pastors to help people out, I truly believe.
Well, Father, thank you so much for giving us your time today and sharing your expertise with us. Can you give us the website again for the Overhaul the Hall?
Oh, yes.
Raffle tickets, please.
DamianRaffle.com. You buy your winning ticket.
Yeah, and the odds are fantastic, people, so don't miss this opportunity. This has been Mary Fiorito sitting in today for Father Anthony on Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
What's there to say when the world makes no sense? Do we search deeper truths or sit on the fence? Can you see? Can you see? Can you see the winds have changed? We marvel and flatter such meaningless thought. The shell appears strong.
the inside is right. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed. What's there to say when right from wrong has become so obscure? It does not take that long, can you see?